From KCRW in Santa Monica, I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner, and this is The Business.
So you still want to do the show business, and you think that you got what it takes? I mean, you really got to rap and be all that, but prepare yourself for the breaks. Check it out.
This week on The Business, everything you wanted to know about being an assistant, but were too terrified to ask. We'll talk with Peter Nowak and Hillary Stamm, authors of The Hollywood Assistant's Handbook, 86 Rules for Aspiring Power Players. Plus, it's one down and one to go in negotiations for a new contract with actors. But first, it's the Hollywood News Caravan. Go nowhere. It's The Business from NPR. We begin with news that Blockbuster will launch a pilot program in June that will allow you to download movies from in-store kiosks and onto portable devices in just 2 minutes. The company hopes to eventually get the download time down to 30 seconds for a, quote, ATM-like experience. The country's largest video rental chain is still in negotiations with Hollywood studios, so it's hard to predict which films will be available. The Blockbuster kiosk, it's worth noting, is designed by NCR, which also builds airline ticketing kiosks, which means that if rentals are $5, they'll be $4 if you rent from Newark. Meanwhile, as your video store turns into an ATM for movies, your TiVo is turning into both box office and TV critic. TiVo reached a deal last week to allow subscribers to rent Disney movies directly from their TVs for a 24-hour period. They also announced that TiVo subscribers in Chicago will be able to download the recommendations of Tribune critic Maureen Ryan with just the click of a remote. But you'll still have to use your Ouija board to get film picks from Pauline Kael. Speaking of the supernatural board game, Ouija Board the Movie has come to life. Plans are afoot to make a theatrical feature out of Hasbro's best-selling game at Universal, where the toy company inked a 6-year strategic partnership last February. While box office is expected to be medium, we predict Ouija Board the Movie will ultimately become an occult classic. Finally, after the runaway global success of the 4th Indiana Jones movie, Paramount has been ineluctably set down the path of making Beverly Hills Cop 4 with Eddie Murphy. It'll be the first cop romp since 1994. Variety reported last week that the original producer, Jerry Bruckheimer, seems to have had the good sense to sit this one out. Brett Ratner is in negotiations to direct. Working title? Axel Foley and the Kingdom of the Swarovski Crystal. And that's the Hollywood News Caravan. Coming up later in the show, just off the Greyhound from Galveston? Planning on making it big in the business? You'll want to stay tuned. But next, AFTRA makes a deal. What's behind door number one for SAG? To no one's surprise, AFTRA, the smaller of the two actors' unions, was able to make a deal with producers. To everyone's surprise, they held firm on several key points and came away with substantial gains in new media. They reached a tentative 3-year deal last Wednesday, leaving SAG the only Hollywood creative guild without a deal. SAG's now left to reheat their talks with producers, which were put on the back burner 3 weeks ago. Leslie Simmons is film, labor, and legal reporter for The Hollywood Reporter. Leslie, welcome to The Business.
Thank you.
So what's the AFTRA deal look like? We know that there's bumps in pay, and there always is for these sorts of things, but what's the real meat of the deal?
The real meat of the deal is that they did get some gains in new media. They have jurisdiction over new media. They have coverage for actors for low-budget new media productions. Those are productions that aren't going to be necessarily on TV, but they are going to be on the Internet. And they also sort of jumped around an issue that came out after SAG finished their negotiations, which was the AMPTP proposing this online clip library to combat piracy on the Internet of clips being used for things like mashups on YouTube. And they still have consent over the use of the clips for now, but that's something that both the AFTRA and the AMPTP are going to revisit and figure out how actors can consent to blanket use of their clips in the future.
Did you get the sense that the reason why they were so reflexive on this was just to be tough and to have some sort of negotiating leverage? Or was it just, is it paranoia that, you know, this is the next great gold rush and we're going to miss out? Or what was it, do you think?
I don't think it's that they're going to miss the next gold rush. It's really image. Image is everything to an actor. And so when they're being asked to give up something, a right that they've had for, you know, 50 years with the studios, whereas, you know, if somebody wants to use a clip of them from a film or a TV show outside of the scope of the promotional use for that program or film, they get the consent of, okay, well, where is it going to be used and how is it going to be used? And if they give that up, then, you know, they're giving up a part of their image. They own their right to publicity. So that was the big thing for them, is just giving up that right and that consent, and not it's sort of not knowing what it's going to be used for.
So is this a good deal or not?
Is it a good deal? I think it's a good deal that they have a deal and that there's not going to be a strike. Is it a good deal? I think it's probably a good deal. They actually did get a good bump in their rates.
So did they get what they were after? I mean, after all this, you know, Sturm und Drang?
I think they got a contract that they can be happy with. After certainly is proud that they were able to negotiate this contract on their own without SAG. They didn't get the DVD bump and residuals that everybody's been trying to get, and that's just something that the studios are just never going to budge on bumping up residuals for DVDs. That's pretty much one of the things that they didn't get that they tried, and SAG is a little more aggressive in that, and we'll see what happens with the negotiations that are going on right now, but more than likely they're not going to get DVD increase either.
So what kind of shape is SAG in going, you know, into negotiations now? I mean, everyone said that this was sort of unprecedented. For the first time in 26 years, they're going to negotiate separately. What kind of shape is SAG going into these talks?
SAG still is the most powerful of the actor unions. They have the most members. They also not only have a primetime deal to negotiate, they have a film deal to negotiate, too. So they do still have some leverage in the talks. However, there is sort of that little cloud hanging over them that AFTRA has already inked a deal as far as the primetime contract goes, and has sort of laid out a type of framework for this big clip issue. But the interesting thing that I found yesterday was that SAG actually was the one that proposed, as part of this this clip deal, that programs produced after July 1st, the performers can bargain the clip consent issue with the employer at the time that they're getting hired. So
why is that significant? They hadn't been able to do that before?
Right. And it's just for the use of clips in new media, and it was something that SAG had tried to work with the AMPTP on in their previous negotiations with them a few weeks ago, and had made this proposal, and the AMPTP didn't agree to it. So it's interesting that then AFTRA made essentially the same proposal, and the AMPTP accepted it. So the
hope here is that, or what people think might be happening is that that the producers are trying to make some accommodations to SAG.
Right. And also that the outlook isn't really that bleak with SAG coming in to start talking today, this afternoon, that this was something we proposed and you liked it, but you liked it when AFTRA proposed it, but that's still our idea and you like our ideas, so let's continue working.
Alan Rosenberg, who's the president of the Screen Actors Guild, his comments in reaction to the AFTRA deal have been sort of the textbook damned with faint praise. I mean, it was very underwhelming, barely even congratulatory.
Yeah.
Are they going to shoot higher? Have they been whipped up to the point where no deal is going to be good enough? And when I say they, I mean the membership.
The feeling is that they're not going to get a 75% approval among their members to if they decide to take a strike vote. So that kind of is an indication that no, they have the support of their membership, but nobody wants to strike, and so they're going to have to work out a deal and maybe pull back a little bit on some things and make some concessions.
We got to leave it there. Leslie Simmons is the film and labor reporter for The Hollywood Reporter. Leslie, thanks for being on The Business.
Thanks, Claude.
They say that working as an assistant for an agent, producer, or executive is the fastest way to learn the ropes in Hollywood. But you also know what they say about giving someone enough rope. So to help you avoid a gallows of your own making, two veteran assistants have written the funny but exceedingly practical Hollywood Assistants Handbook, 86 Rules for Aspiring Power Players. Hilary Stamm is the assistant to the head of a major film studio. Peter Nowalk was previously enslaved at a talent agency, a production company, and a studio before becoming a writer. And he's now on staff at Grey's Anatomy. Hilary, Peter, welcome to the business.
Thank you for having us.
Yes.
If you had to boil down to sort of one maxim, you know, what it takes to be a great assistant, what is it? I mean, be what?
Be courageous, I think. The worst mistake you can make as an assistant is to just fall into the trap of getting lattes, thinking that's all you're cut out for. And I think to be courageous, to know when you're prepared enough to go to your boss, give your opinion that may be contrary to theirs, and also to ask for more responsibility, whether that's a promotion or just whether you want to read scripts and do notes and sit in on meetings but not talk. But you have to be courageous and really ask for what you want, or else you will always be an assistant.
Mm-hmm. My other one would be resourceful. Being resourceful sounds so easy, but when you have to find some, you know, esoteric Christmas gift for some person in a matter of 12 hours and you can come up with some creative response and give your boss, you know, four options, it's moments like that where they're like, wow, you're worth my time. And then that also makes up for when the mistakes happen, because the mistakes will happen.
And especially to be resourceful and to be brave, those are qualities that you need to make it, obviously, in Hollywood, but whatever job you're doing.
Yeah.
So these are skills you're teaching yourself, not so you're a great assistant, but so you're a great producer or you're a great director or whatever you eventually want to become.
So you've, of course, set us up perfectly for the segue. Mistakes do happen. I want to talk about handling the ballistic boss.
One of our favorite lessons, are you thinking of the one I'm thinking of, is in the book, it's the overreaction, underreaction system. And, you know, if your boss overreacts to something, and you're anticipating, you've messed up, they're going to be really upset, you actually blow it up and make it even bigger, a bigger deal, so they can be like, oh, Hilary, that's not that big of a deal. Don't even worry about it. And so we give a lot of little tricks of the trade of how to, like, kind of get into the boss's psyche to make the situation better. Because the fact of the matter is, there's a lot of pressure, there's a lot of money involved, there's, you know, they're a high-stakes business. So if you can actually get in there and, you know,
psychologically manipulate them, you make a big deal about it. You are guilty. You maybe cry. But they will back down when they see that. And they'll also appreciate the fact that you're taking it so seriously. I mean, the reason why I think people get so angry about things, why bosses like Ari Gold exist, is because they take it seriously. And they want to know that the person they're spending 14 hours a day with is taking it as seriously.
But not to, I think, paid prostitutes or something. But what is it about people's tempers that seems to be almost a caricature of themselves? You know, it gets made fun of on TV because it's good comedy, but there is a basis in reality. I'm wondering why so, you know, to paraphrase the Joker, why so serious?
We have our, we wish it wasn't so serious for sure, especially when you are working for someone like that. We have a joke in the book that whenever that happens, whenever it seems like everything's going to fall apart, you do a mantra to yourself. You're not curing cancer. You're not curing cancer.
But Hilary, what do you think about this?
Well, I would like to interject one little thing, that I think that the Ari Golds of the world, they kind of get all the play. And when I had some feedback from executives at studios where I'd worked, people said, what about all these good bosses? And I know that's kind of the alternative to what you're looking for, but what's amazing is how many bosses aren't that way. And you kind of don't hear about them. I mean, lots of really hardworking, really amazing people in the business.
So you hear more about the Scott Rudins of the world.
I just feel like you hear about the crazies, and those are the ones who get written up.
But and I think it's also a mad scientist type of thing. These are people that are really talented. The people that you hear about that yell and scream are also the most powerful people because in a way, they're living in their own heads. They're geniuses at what they do. And so the bad behavior can kind of be permitted more than it would be. If they were bad at their jobs, they wouldn't be allowed to act like that. They'd have to be nice. I feel bad for the people that have to work for them, but hopefully they'll know better than to stay there for too long.
So it tends to be this is, you know, it's not that the coffee is not the color of an Alaskan Malamute. It's more, you know, we're $60 million over on this movie, and Wall Street's going to cut our stock in half.
I think it does. It manifests itself in different ways. So maybe, you know, the movie came in way over budget and opening weekend showed awful numbers at the box office. But then it might manifest itself in, why is the trip to Aruba, why am I leaving on the 12th and not the 13th like I asked, and why am I not in bulkhead seating in the front? Whatever it is, you know, it manifests itself in those ways. And I've had a lot of bosses where, okay, we're mad about this, but I think we're actually upset about this. And, you know, you learn the people you work for and their idiosyncrasies.
And not to take anything personally, when they're yelling at you, they are not yelling at you. They're yelling at some weird dysfunction in their own life or their job.
Hence the mantra. Start chanting the mantra when that happens.
You're not curing cancer.
That's a very dispassionate answer. I'm very impressed that you guys have achieved this sort of...
Oh, the thick skin is your basic tool as an assistant starting out. And if you don't have it, you better grow it fast.
We say thicken up that skin stat.
Or, yeah, just go back home to work the job at your dad's accounting firm.
So let's rank in order of their importance here. Talents and smarts, connections, chutzpah, schmoozing, ruthlessness.
Wow. I'm big with the chutzpah. You know I'm big with that.
I am too. I think that's our main mantra in this book is perseverance and...
And charisma. I mean, I think those two things. And resilience. I know you didn't use that word, but I'm going to use it. I mean, because even though connections can get you a long way, I remember I had this one intern once and he was connected beyond all belief. But at the end of the day, he didn't work hard. He couldn't copy a script properly. And he wasn't out to, you know, work the extra mile and go the extra mile or whatever the saying is. And so I think that those are the things that are really important. It's you can be really connected, but if you're not going to get in there and do the work, nobody cares.
Yeah, connections only get you so far. For sure, they'll get your foot in the door, but it's up to you what you do when you get there. And I mean, nepotism is notorious in this town, but I really think it's the people that use their nepotism well. They're naturally talented anyway, and they would have made it.
They would have persevered anyway.
If they were not related to anyone famous.
Yeah. That's true.
Frenemies. You know, in regular civilian life, our enemies are people we do not typically associate with, let alone form alliances. In Hollywood, not so much. Explain the term as it relates to being an assistant as you each see it.
I think the brilliance in frenemies is there's just bound to be people that you're going to have to work with, regardless of if you like them or not. And it's those people, it's those difficult ones and how you deal with them, which makes you the cream rise to the top. If you're able to deal with that ridiculously difficult agent who, you know, you can never seem to please, but you can charm him and woo him even though, you know, you can't stand him, that's where you're really going to, you know, set yourself apart.
Actual story, please.
Right. Actual story?
Yeah. Actual story.
Okay. Like, for instance, the Lakers tickets. You've got to get floor seats for some special star. And you can't stand this agent. You can't even stand the star. All they do is ask you for things. They never give you anything in return. But you come through in, like, you know, the final inning and you get them the floor seats to the Lakers. And this happened where, you know, we had done something for someone. They never, ever said boo after favor, after favor, after favor. And then finally you get the, you know, recognition and you say, wow, see, I killed them with kindness. And now they know my name. And now I can get a job at their production company. So it matters.
Coming up after a short break, more with Peter Nowak and Hilary Stamm, authors of The Hollywood Assistant's Handbook, 86 Rules for Aspiring Power Players. Some of our favorites, rule number 57, beware the overshare, and rule number 34, add chore whore to your resume. You're listening to The Business from NPR. You're listening to The Business, and I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. The surest way to get to learn the business, make frenemies, and start your trek to the top of the Hollywood heap is to get a gig as an assistant to an agent, producer, or executive. To help you ease into your new place on the bottom of the business totem pole, Peter Nowak and Hilary Stamm have written the funny but practical Hollywood Assistant's Handbook, 86 Rules for Aspiring Power Players. Is there a point at which you are entitled as an assistant to say, you know what, screw you, I don't have to do that?
We always say, do not burn bridges unless you know you're going to go take that LSAT, be a lawyer, and never look back at Hollywood. But really, don't burn the bridges. And say you work for a really, really powerful boss. You are going to get ridiculous requests. And I have had instances where I was able to go to my boss and say, you know, so-and-so is asking for this. And my boss would say, that's ridiculous. We do not need to get them that, or we do not need to do that for them. And you can go back and then say, I'm sorry, I wish I could, but it's my boss. So it's always about, you know, playing it off and making those people feel important, because it's all about making people feel important.
Let's talk about the flow of information in Hollywood. I think a lot gets made about what they call tracking boards, basically this sort of vast honeycomb of information that assistants are all like little bees trafficking in, pollinating, running around with. Explain what it is and whether that's still how things work for you guys.
A tracking board is basically just a group of people who all have some sort of like email connection and will trade secrets. I mean, I think the key to being part of a good tracking board is that you know everyone on it, and it's small and it's intimate, and you have a certain level of trust with these people. I mean, there are definitely tracking boards that have like 300 members and people are just spreading gossip or putting up anonymous postings somehow. Obviously, you wouldn't trust those, but they're definitely helpful, especially for assistants who are trying to impress their boss and get information.
And in the book, we talk about the flow of information and the fact that as a high-powered assistant, you are going to, you know, a lot of confidential and privileged information that shouldn't be given out, that you shouldn't go blowing on the tracking boards. So we talk about how be careful. Once you have access to that power, it is how you use it, and use it to your advantage. Don't go tell your friend at the, you know, competing studio, oh, I actually know what we're going to bid for that spec. There's a quick way to lose the job. So,
but I would also imagine that having that kind of knowledge is, in a certain respect, essential to doing your job well. That is, if your boss wants you to be the assistant that they've always dreamed of, you're going to have to trade in information that they might, if you were to tell them to their face, you know, I just traded this to get that, their hair would turn white, or they would shoot you out of the window. But in point of fact, that's how you have to do it sometimes. Is that fair to say?
That's definitely fair, especially if you're working for someone, say, who's a lower-level executive and they're trying to put movies together or put projects together, and you have access to information and you can say, hey, I just figured out that, you know, Keanu dropped out of that film. My friend over at Fox said he's not the lead anymore. And then you can make your boss look good, because that's what it's always about, making your boss look good. And your boss can go in, you know, put Keanu back on our short list. He's available now.
There's a sort of fine balance here, I'm getting the sense, between serving the needs of your boss and playing your cards right and showing that you want to be more than an assistant at some point. How do you express that?
You have to express it soon, and I think it's more by action than by words. And I think it's the key to moving up to the next level is always to do the job above you. So even if it's your second week on the job, you have to be thinking about the future. To just sit back and kind of coast by as an assistant for a few years is the worst thing you can do for yourself, for your own ambition.
We give examples of if you're up for a job, or say you're up for two different jobs, and we give examples, well, one pays a lot more, seems to be a better production company, but this person doesn't seem to have any interest in helping you along with your career or teaching you what they've learned, then take the job that pays $1 zillion less, and the person's going to let you sit in on story meetings, because that's how you're going to learn, and that's how you're going to find the next thing for you. So I think that's really, really crucial in kind of the architecture of your career.
It's to surround yourself with good people and people that you admire and respect. Sure, that's not always an option when you're first starting out. You have to take the crappy job with the crappy boss, but don't stay long in that job. Always be looking for something else.
I'm wondering if you think that the widely reported abuse of assistants is something that happens because there's a sort of cycle of violence here. You know, because the agent or the studio head or whoever it is that you're working for was previously an assistant and was hazed in this horrible fashion, that they feel this need to somehow give you your stripe.
You know, when I have not experienced that kind of I've never seen this so-called hazing.
Hillary had a lot of good bosses.
And that's, you know, when we make the Prada and Hollywood version of this book, I kind of want to put that out there, that there's people, it can be a really fun, crazy world, and it could be a great series or show. We have a lot of ideas. But it doesn't have to be, you know, like Prada. It doesn't have to be some Miranda Priestly crazed woman. You don't have to be a bitch to be brilliant. Can I say that? Sorry.
I think you just did. One of the amusing things in your book is you offer various tests along the way to test your knowledge. One of your questions, and maybe this is tongue-in-cheek, maybe it's not, but I'd still want to hear the answer from either of you or both of you, is you say, question six in your first quiz, agents are fundamentally good people, true or false? And the answer you give is unequivocally B, false.
Of course.
They are loathsome, disgusting people who should be rounded up and shot like a pack of lame mules. So my question to you is,
did not say that.
Well, you didn't quite say that, but you basically said they're bad people. So why?
Well, that is our quiz that comes at the beginning of the book, and it's definitely tongue-in-cheek, and it's called The Quiz Is How You Know If You're a Moron and If You Should Pack Up Your Corolla and Move Back Home. If you come out thinking that agents are nice, fun, supportive people that just want their clients to succeed, you need to have a reality check.
You know, it's funny. I've never actually worked at an agency, so I have my own kind of preconceived notions of what it must be like in there, and I've always thought, the type of people who are attracted to being an agent, it is definitely a very different breed, I think that's fair to say, than the type of people who are going to go be what we call in the book and what's a common term in Hollywood, a D-girl, who's going to stay up all night and read 400 scripts and write lots of scene breakdown and story notes. That agent has got to be the one who's out there brokering, out there trying to steal clients. By the nature, that's the tough, kind of gritty part of the biz. And so I think it's kind of a different group of people that are probably attracted to that kind of job.
Is there such a thing as a career assistant in Hollywood?
Yes. And
definitely.
How do you find out if that's the job you just mistakenly took?
Oh, that's a good question.
We have a lesson like that at the end of the book. We think it's very funny. It's like if you wake up and you're already thinking about lunch. Or
you start ordering cupcakes because somebody like passed their driving test and got their license or something really mundane like that.
You know you're a lifer at that point. But I think you're only a lifer in your job if you stay in it for too long. And that's fine if that's what you want. I think a lot of people realize that or they get a nice boss and they're like, you know what, this isn't bad and I want this job and I'm okay with doing it. That's not really what our book is for.
We're not really catering to those people.
No, it's for the people who definitely want out and want bigger and better. And so there's a shelf life to working for one person, even if they're the most powerful person in Hollywood. I don't think you can work for them for more than a few years without moving on to the next thing. I mean, it's a self-respect thing at that point. The longer you stay in that job, the longer they will see you as one type of person, and that's the person that answers their phone.
Peter Nowak is a writer on Grey's Anatomy. He started out as an assistant. Hilary Stamm is the assistant to the head of a major film studio in Hollywood. They are both the authors of Hollywood Assistant's Handbook, 86 Rules for Aspiring Power Players. Hilary, Peter, thanks for being on The Business.
Thank you so much for having us.
And that's The Business. Matt Holzman produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. Our associate producer is Darby Maloney. You can listen to this or any past program online anytime at kcrw.com/thebusiness. You can also podcast the show on KCRW's site or through iTunes. Our email address is thebusiness@kcrw.org. The Business is produced by KCRW Santa Monica and distributed by National Public Radio. I'm Club Rodessa Ackner. We'll see you next week on The Business.